welcome to this broadcast of Citizens for Transparent Government Radio. I'm pleased to be joined today by Klamath County Commissioner Dennis Linthicum and a gentleman that I know locally who's very active in politics who goes by the name of Mr. X. Welcome, guys. It's great to speak to you today.
Good afternoon, Eric. It's good to be online.
Today we're going to talk about a rather new form of governance as opposed to government through our traditional representative government process. Not that many people know about this, and at the same time, it's rather extensive in its deployment and use in terms of how policymaking impacts every American's lives. All of us live in Oregon, so we'll be given some examples that are pertinent to Oregon, but this really does extend to a national footprint. And this whole octopus, as we joke about it, in terms of policy formation, has as its intellectual godfather, amongst other organizations, an organization called the Policy Consensus Initiative. And you can look this up on the website, and I'll include a link to this in the write-up for the show, but it's policyconsensus.org. And, you know, that would be instructive for people to take a look at. But in a nutshell, to describe this, we need to back up a step and just talk about what normal representative government is. And people have a decent understanding of that from a civics point of view. We have elected representatives, and laws are formed within the legislature, and supposedly there's a level of accountability because people can be voted out, and supposedly our ideas and necessary considerations for local government and local conditions get filtered upwards, and, you know, that's the whole democratic republic model of our government. Now, obviously, there's a lot of flaws in that when it comes to how money bastardizes politics and corporations as persons, you know, shape political systems and so forth. That's all well understood by most Americans, but there's another aspect that's evolved within the last couple of decades and certainly picked up a heck of a lot of steam in the last decade that shapes the political process at the county level and impacts all of our lives directly that a lot of people don't know about. And that's what we jokingly call the consensus policy octopus and how it involves non-governmental organizations and so forth. And this Policy Consensus Initiative is basically a think tank. You can think of it in that respect. And they hook up with other means of transmitting the structure of governance versus governing through the representative government with, you know, the university system across the United States. And they have a formal coalition under a body called the University Network for Collaborative Governance. And just to draw a distinction as to how this actually works in its mechanics, policies that are envisioned by special interests and by, you know, governors or maybe even presidents or what have you, flow through this kind of a brain trust. And in terms of implementing these policies at the local level, non-governmental organizations, and in the case of Oregon, we have an organization locally called RVCOG, and that does the bring together consensus holders as opposed to the process of forming policy when it comes to representative government. So, you know, with that as an introduction, I'd love for you guys to talk about this more and to flesh it out and give people an understanding of how this whole model of governance works. And before I toss it open, I'd also want to just point out that these organizations are actually pretty open when it comes to how they seek policymakers to adopt these kind of strategies to implement policy. And as an example, the Policy Consensus Initiative published a practical guide to consensus, and they published, quite literally, a cautionary note: participation is the key to legitimacy. Government-sponsored consensus processes are not the traditional form in which policies are made, administered, or adjudicated in a democracy. In traditional forms, the mechanisms for determining who participates directly in the writing and administration of law are spelled out in constitutions, charters, statutes, and rules. Consensus-seeking processes are adjuncts to traditional democratic processes. They can shift the locus of policy decision-making. I mean, these folks that are behind this whole intellectual architecture are very open with what they're building and how it actually is a form of replacement of representative democracy. That's the threat that we want to expound upon and elucidate for our listening audience here. So, gentlemen, take away.
Eric, you did a fantastic job of summarizing, and your point here in traditional forums, the mechanisms for determining how regulations and rules and administration are created are typically in charters or statutes or rules that everybody knows ahead of time, and then there's representative availability for all of the citizens within a community. But you and I both know that as men and women throughout America are busy working and maybe pursuing their own educational dreams or their own lifestyle dreams, trying to get the kids to soccer practice, any number of those things that occupy their thoughts and time, they aren't necessarily available to go to a meeting on Tuesday afternoon because they've got other things going on. So go to the very first part of what you said. Participation is the key to legitimacy. Tell me, who in the world actually believes a statement like that? Participation is the key to legitimacy? Are you kidding me? Participation has nothing to do with legitimacy. Participation, especially in this consensus environment, is where hand-chosen individuals get pick to participate and sway the vote or the election for this subgroup. When I say election, it's not like a Tuesday in November. It's actually a decision made by a board of 8 people or 12 people or 24 people, as in the case of the KBRA here in Oregon, where they decided to blow 3 hydroelectric dam facilities. And you have to ask, well, what about all the ratepayers and taxpayers? Where are their votes? And their votes don't count. It's the people who got invited to the meeting on Tuesday afternoon who get the vote to execute that agreement.
And as a Klamath County Commissioner, you have a lot of insight into the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, KBRA. And it's my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but there were 27 stakeholders, quote-unquote, that were ultimately nominated. There were only 3 that were representing local ranching / agricultural interests. And then, you know, the state-level government has a seat at the table. And you can speak to how the county commissioners got, you know, circumvented in the process of KBRA. But then the vast majority of the other stakeholders that make the decisions as to whether or not to blow up these dams and how water rights would be impacted in terms of, you know, their goal of increasing habitat for salmon and so forth are environmental organizations by about half, you know, half of the stakeholders, if not more, are NGOs, not people who live in the county. I mean, for all intents and purposes, you can have, you know, a branch of the Sierra Club in New York State having a seat at this table. I mean, those kind of things happen indirectly when it comes to the funding of these organizations, certainly. So it's not a democratic process where local people impacted by policies that are put into place actually have a direct say. The reason why they say, cautionary note, participation is key to legitimacy is because the organization actually recognizes that the whole structure in and of itself is by definition not representative and therefore at threat for being not legitimate.
It is not legitimate, and that's the point that I hope people walk away with today after hearing Ed describe how the policy consensus organization started and where it comes from. And you're right, Eric. Thanks for pointing that out. I referred to the KBRA, and I'm a Klamath County commissioner in southern Oregon, central southern Oregon, and Klamath County has one of the dams, and Siskiyou County in Northern California has 3 other dams, and those dams generate 168 megawatts of electricity, which is sorely needed in California, of all places, and to blow that electric generation capacity is certainly not in the best interest of ratepayers. But by golly, it will be in the interest of all of those developers who want to put in renewable energy sources, whether it be wind or solar or gas-fired or whatnot, but hydro facilities are apparently not considered renewable in the state of Oregon.
Quite literally, by law, actually. I think it was 2007 that they restricted the classification of hydro as renewable because to do so would remove the number one competitor to solar and wind projects, which would receive federal grants of support, and that money would not have flown if it were competing against truly cheap and abundant renewable resources in the form of hydropower, which Oregon has in spades.
If Oregon were to consider hydro facilities as renewable, 65% of all of Oregon's electric generation would be considered renewable, and that industry has in place what they call renewable portfolio standards. California is shooting for 20% and 25%. Oregon would be sitting at 65%. Now, while Oregon would have 65%, they wouldn't be able to qualify for any federal funding for renewable energy sources. So California then, quote unquote, would be getting all of the funding stream because they're only at 14% today and they want to get to 20 and they want to get to 25. So the commissioners, the state representatives, the state senators in Oregon decided, well, we'll consider hydro as non-renewable energy, and that way we'll qualify for federal funding. And the federal monetary policy, this loose money printing machine that we have at the federal level, is the biggest problem we face, because with money, you can buy consensus, and with this consensus policy, all you need is a handful of men who are willing to say yes to the money, and all of a sudden you've got a consensus, and you've all of a sudden got a policy that you impact the entire paying public, the taxpaying public with, and they didn't get a seat at the table. It's really a crime.
One of the other aspects of that I'm going to throw in here is to remember that the KBRA program, there were of the list of stakeholders that they brought together, one of them was called the Klamath Watershed Partnership. And in research on their own website, there was a link in there on their own page that took you to the source of a $400,000 grant. And when you click on their page on that link, it takes you to the Hatfield Group out of Canada. So you look at how the unfairness of this and the unlimited tentacles of this octopus. Now you have $400,000 coming in from out of the country to help fight this program, to help put together this program. I shouldn't say fight the program. Their goal was to reach this agreement that they came up with. So now these groups are funded where the people locally, the individuals, the three people that were on there that were legitimate stakeholders, had no sources of revenues to do anything with. And you look at this entire thing, and it just becomes so disturbing when you see these things come about.
Yeah, and from a big picture perspective, the consensus policy governance system, as opposed to governing or government, is couched in terms that, you know, an average person hearing the language would say, oh, this is pretty innocuous, so consensus. Wouldn't we all want to come to a consensus? That's supposedly a good thing. But in reality, we can't stress this enough. This is an alternative layer mechanism of governance, attempting to put forward policies that normally, as they openly explain at the website of the Policy Consensus Initiative, policies that would normally not be able to be executed and implemented through the normal government of representative democracy that we, you know, all believe we have, but is being eroded by this system. And again, to remind folks, the reason why we're focusing on this, it's a little bit obscure to some extent, but it's important to shine a light on all of this because very few people understand that this system is up and running. And to take any kind of, people understand pretty well how the whole administrative arm of government has grown very aggressively. And to put that into context, in 2013, Congress, in Washington, D.C., produced about 2,300 pages worth of law that made it through the entire process and was signed by the president. When you look at administrative rules that were passed in 2013 through the bureaucracies like the BLM and the USDA and the FDA and on and on and on, we're talking 81,000 pages. So the vast majority of the growth in our government, be it at the national level certainly, but even at the state level, is this kind of administrative bureaucratic machine that is having impacts on literally every aspect of our lives. And as part of the tools used to shape and direct where these bureaucracies have an impact on public policy, this consensus model has risen to being one of the most important aspects of shaping this administrative bureaucratic octopus. So, Ed, can you walk people through an example of how policy would begin at the policy consensus initiative and then hook up to the university systems and flow through the university network for collaborative governance and the Hatfield School of Government and Portland State University, and then all of a sudden it ends up being the guiding light for RVCOG at the local level, and then the county commissioners hook up with RVCOG and everyone sings Kumbaya, where stakeholders through the process of these non-governmental organizations represent, you know, special interests taking control of public policy to pad their own or pursuant to their own interests. Flesh that out a bit and help our listeners understand it.
I'll go through first the relationship thing of what you touched on. Folks understand that this is not part of Oregon only. This has been a program in design that is working nationwide, and part of the Policy Consensus Initiative is the National Policy Consensus Center. Oregon Solutions is under this, but if you go to their website, you'll see they have all different states under solutions, okay? They're actively developing this, and where it stems from is through a legal principle called the alternative dispute resolution. And when they go into different states, the Oregon model goes into an area that has somewhat of an active, how to say, radical grouping, and that's where they use the University Network for Collaborative Governance so that they can get these programs involved and the people, the right people involved that they want. They source mostly radical people that don't care about the, the process as it should be, as we were going through earlier. Now, the National Policy Consensus Center sponsors all of these things through different states. And then the Policy Consensus Initiative is there also. And then you have a model under the Oregon Solutions Network. Now, the Oregon Solutions Network was involved in the last resource management plan by the BLM here in Oregon. Now, in Southern Oregon, there was a public meeting called where the public is supposed to have input into forming these plans so that the economies don't suffer. Now, here in Oregon, a lot of our land is managed by the BLM as opposed to other states. On a percentage basis, it's quite high. So the ONC Act is how they balance certain things about timber revenue for logging activity and forest activity. Well, to make a round circle into this all, under Oregon Solutions, they brought in a group called DNS Consulting. A stakeholder group was formed. They put together alternatives. Now, if you read their own documentation, their alternatives that they presented for the public's input. Well, the public didn't get to give their own input. The public got to give input on the alternatives that were pre-selected. And the alternatives that were pre-selected by a group of people who agreed in advance to agree to the means to an end. These alternatives were not brought about by them in any other way other than showing a running consensus at the end. And that's the backbone of rulemaking, lawmaking, and things. There has to be shown a need of things, and they're substituting the public demand for the, you know, with the stakeholder demand, the stakeholder process, and they're eliminating the public process. And with when you look at the BLM RMP that was presented, now you go to the meeting, and it's done in a Delphi technique. They only want to talk about the subject matter of the alternatives that are there, when by public process we should have any alternative be considered that the public is looking at, and in grouping, looking at as a problem regionally for the area. So you have an effective control that comes about from a group that can be hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away, and it's engineering any sort of logical, necessary things that we have to have to, how to say, just demands of someone who has an ideal, someone who has an idea of what is happening or what they want to see, and this person may not even be affected or be around that type of thing. But yet we're all suffering because these groups are controlling these rules, these administrative rules that go into play after this.
Yeah.
Right.
Another great example, I think, that will help some people who have an understanding already of what is Agenda 21 and how that can inform an understanding of this policy consensus octopus that we're describing, would be to look at, say, how non-governmental organizations are essentially the handmaidens to translating the vision of Agenda 21 as formulated principally at the Rio conference in 1992 in Brazil. And though it is not, in fact, outright law in the United States, we still have organizations like ICLEI at a local level in many counties across the United States, and the environmental NGOs, generically speaking, as well, but also the National American Planning Association taking basically vision of a prescription as to how to do sustainable development and so forth from the Clinton administration onward, through all of these NGOs shaping local policy decisions. And then the great example would be how the EPA is regulating the amount of particulates that can be in wood stove burning and so forth. All of these things are translating a vision defined by special interests into local government, and predominantly doing it through non-governmental organizations that use this consensus model to make kind of like an astroturf claim of representing local populations. I mean, a really, really, really big impact that's going to come down the pike in the not-too-distant future for every single American is carbon taxes. And my estimation is that they're going to push this down America's throat in 2016 during the transition for the presidential election. And it's going to be justified on basically unconfirmed, and if not all the way to the extent of junk science about climate change dynamic going on and the anthropogenic claims and whatnot, and an attempt to roll back carbon output to 1990 levels. In order to do that, you have to, you know, account for all the growth in the population and economic activity that generates carbon as a byproduct of absolutely everything that goes on economically. So you can imagine that we're talking about a gigantic reduction in the amount of economic activity associated with this carbon output. So you have all these NGOs and so forth forming the architecture that this policy, a goal of Agenda 21, is being translated through. And a lot of people in our listening audience will already have a pretty decent understanding of Agenda 21 and everything I just outlined. But it does hook up to this consensus policy architecture that's rolled out, because, frankly, these kind of special interest champion goals would never make it through the sunshine of the normal legislative process. And Dennis, you've got a lot of experience on this, directly seeing this in Klamath County. I wonder if you can just expound on what I just outlined and linkages to the bigger picture so that people can once again just kind of backstep and see how this whole architecture works.
Eric, I think one of the best examples that would illustrate tentacles of this system would be the National Ambient Air Quality Standard that exists and implemented by the EPA at the federal level. It applies to all 50 states. And yet all 50 states have unique landscapes and environments and population centers and industries and whatnot. And for the federal government to set a single standard across that enormous landscape is really, you know, kind of the fatal conceit that Hayek referred to about central planning and the know-it-alls in Washington. But more to the point, how the EPA accomplishes their ends is every single of the 50 states have some sort of Department of Environmental Quality, whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency, or in Oregon, it's the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of Oregon, or whatever. Those agencies are basically submitting jurisdiction to the EPA. So when the EPA comes out with a standard like the PM2.5 standard, which is a particulate matter standard, 2.5 is the microns in diameter of a particulate that would get caught in a filter that would be, you know, in a monitoring station somewhere. The EPA sets a standard. They organize the data. They define what the regulatory constraints are, what the sanctions are, what the size and quantity count of the particulate matter should look like. And then they say, da-da, implement it at the county level. So the state gets the rule, comes to the county and tells the county commissioners, write an ordinance to make sure that your citizens remain safe from this harmful pollution constituent. But the whole game is made up with special interests who are pursuing alternative forms of energy. For example, in Klamath County, we use a lot of wood stoves and a lot of wood heat for a very small population. There's 20,000 people in the city of Klamath Falls and a total of 60,000 people in the entire county. Those 60,000 people in a forested area of the state of Oregon actually do a great service to the community by offloading the debris that's in a forest, offloading the undergrowth and the biomass fuel load that is building up within the forest, and it's used to provide wood heat instead of go up in smoke during a thunderstorm and raging forest fire that happens during the summertime. The EPA sets a rule, then they provide mitigation efforts in terms of funding to the state. The state provides that funding to county commissioners and says, don't worry, this sounds hard, but we'll provide money for you and we'll help replace wood stoves, we'll help bring in natural gas, we'll help, we'll help, we'll help. So everybody's on board. If it's not going to hurt, I guess I can go along with this. And then now that you're in the funding stream and now that you're dependent upon those monies, you're essentially trapped and your citizens have lost the freedom to even, you know, comment about the quality of the air that they're breathing because of the standards that are in place. They just lose their entire ability to be part of the system. The special interests are the ones who are forming consensus and developing the rules.
That's top down, you know, big solution for all different communities across the country, regardless of what is applicable in a local community.
Yeah, very much top down. And imagine how different it would look if in one small community they may be willing to live under these conditions because they have an industry that is part of their heritage. And then in another community, they're kind of feeling a little bit more like they're second homes and they're tourists or they're focusing on, you know, creating a beautiful, pristine environment versus an industrial environment. To imagine that we could create a regulation that would regulate the industrial neighborhood with the same degree, precision, and requirements that we regulate the tourist community, that seems really weird, because what we're saying is that the tourist community standards would be the standards that we would issue across all 50 states from East Coast to West Coast, and that is what we're seeing. We're seeing standards. Look at today, the Obama administration and the EPA is trying to shut coal out of the marketplace. And even if we took every one of our coal-fired facilities offline, China will be adding more than that during the next 5 years. And so this is really a silly, isolated problem based on performance for special interests, not based on real science for the health of our neighborhoods and our community, let alone the prosperity that comes from economic freedom.
Ed, I know that you've been following water issues in the state of Oregon very closely, and that's also another example of the kind of things that we've been talking about. I wonder if you can dive into that and paint a picture for folks as to how water is, and the regulation of water is an example of this consensus policy octopus up and running in Oregon.
It's actually a great point to show where this affects nationwide. As Dennis was just outlining, these policies that they engineer are coming across the board everywhere. So in particular, when you look at Oregon, one of the things that occurred was there was a lawsuit that was called a sue and settle lawsuit that started all of this, which has been attacked lately and hopefully, you know, slowed up somewhat. But nonetheless, this has already occurred here. What happened was in Northwest Environmental Advocates, I think it was, up in out of the Portland area, sued the EPA over the Clean Water Act for the water standards in Oregon. Now, the EPA then came to the DEQ in Oregon with a list of settlement demands that were in this lawsuit. Now, the EPA never, it's important to understand this. What happens is the EPA never fought the lawsuit. No one ever defended the opposite position. They basically caved in to the demands and then forced those demands upon the state. So now when you have this top-down control, this is what occurs. So now, when you have the process that I just explained, you have to understand, under the Oregon Solutions Program now, they convened a commission, and then they created a program called the Oregon, it was called the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. Now, this became the foundation for everything that we're seeing now as what we're fighting in water type issues. And most currently, the Gold Hill Irrigation District. There was another situation that was brought up by Water Watch, where they came in and talked to one of the people out there, and basically he was in a position of control, and the next thing you know, right in the middle of the irrigation season, they shut off their water based upon alterations to a system that's been there for almost 100 years. And every part of it, as you look at it, has no, consideration for the active person that has demands upon that irrigation to be a producer. Every part of this system, this integrated water resources strategy, was brought about by a group of stakeholders. The alternatives that they considered to put the demands back to the DEQ were all part of a program that was fathered in by a document in Oregon that was called the Roadmap to 2020 and the Vision Plan to 2050. And they're top-down outlines of what they want to accomplish. And if you're looking at this and you're trying to consider what is happening to America, you have to go into each state, you know, wherever you live. Go into your Department of Environmental Quality. Go into your, you know, organization. Start searching these things out, and you will find these groups working on proposing and putting together these types of just ridiculous rules that they'll use administratively. And that's the whole key that people understand, is that these, you know, like what you were outlining earlier, It's administrative rules, and that's how they're going to take over. You don't have, if you're a violator under these conditions, you don't have a right to trial by jury. In Oregon, you have constitutionally based facts that you are supposed to have a trial by jury. Well, under the administrative rules, you don't have a trial by jury. So they attack it. One man interprets the rules and then decides if you're, you know, what type of fine you pay. And basically it's another revenue stream because there's no way they can alter the rules that they want to alter. They can interpret them. The entire grouping of this falls into a system of control from a distance, and that's the important factor of it all to remember.
And can you explain to our listeners who don't have as much of a focus on Oregon, what is Oregon Solutions?
Oregon Solutions is a part of the group that you were talking about earlier. It comes down to, in 1989, Oregon brought about a program called the Dispute Resolution Commission. Now, in 2003, they dissolved it, abolished it, as it was, I guess was their term, but they abolished it, but they kept the funding. Now, they claim they abolished it for financial reasons. The real reality was is it was time to implement the plan of using this. So you look at it, and what they did is they used the court system. They're using the judicial branch of our governmental system, and they're taking a section of it under alternative dispute resolution. They created and gave it to the university system and created this whole octopus with it. And by doing so, they gave it to Portland State University, and it's housed there, and then there's the Hatfield School of Government, which basically has it. But at that point, all of these organizations are at the same building, same address. All of them fall under this, and they're, each one is a different layer and handles one slightly different aspect of this. So the Oregon Solutions Program is part of the consensus network, and what it does is that they decide at a top-down level what part they want to go after, they convene a stakeholder group, they handpick who goes into it. These people have to, before they're even considered as part of this, they have to agree to the end before they're done. Okay, before they actually sit down at the table and be considered stakeholders, they have to be in agreement that they will agree to the end no matter what. They have a process that they follow through and do this, but now when you have the Oregon Solutions part of it, now then under Oregon Solutions, then you have the Regional Solutions Network, that comes under there. Then you have the RV COGS. You'll have the RV COGS, like you outlined a little bit earlier. That's the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. Now, if you start looking at their terms, collaborative, collaboration, stakeholder, RV COG, which is the council. Now, you look at these things, these are basically Soviet-style, backgrounds of all of the government processes they did administratively. They sit back with all of these things, and every time that we ask for government to be more transparent, they make it so you can't see it. We don't see what's going on, but you follow these groups down line, and you find each one has a specified purpose, like the grant revenue stream is basically RV COG's responsibility on a local level. Every time that there is a process that has to happen here, the Rogue Valley Council of Government sources grants to make it happen. So now there's different offshoots of the revenue stream that come into that into play at this point, too. There was a group here a year ago, I believe, sued the city of Medford. They sued the city of Medford for the effluent temperature being 1 degree too high in the Rogue River. Now, temperature of the Rogue River can be controlled anytime that you want through the layer of water that they exit from the reservoir. And they sued and won. The city of Medford settled the suit, and I think it's $8 million to plant trees for shade along the Rogue River for 1 degree, which all they had to do was to have the Army Corps of Engineers alter the temperature at the reservoir on the outflow. So you look at this, it adds a tremendous, point of These people are becoming so well-funded through us, the taxpayers. Every time we turn around, the taxpayer is funding more and more and more. And basically, at this point, what we're doing now, if the U.S. government is borrowing so much of this money from China, and then they're giving it out in grants to accompany, you know, these people through their process of change that they want to do with these types of programs, we're getting deeper and deeper into an enslavement process. And it's just astounding to me that we have allowed it to go on, but it's so hard to see. And this is what's so important for people to understand. You look for government. You don't look for governance. And that's the difference. You have to become very, very critical in thinking on how that terminology is used.
You mentioned Vision 2020 and 2050, and those are great examples as well, too, because they do hook up to that whole broadly defined universe of policy wet dreams of Agenda 21, to be crude.
That's exactly right.
Essentially what we're talking about, and people do have a better understanding of Agenda 21, so I keep bringing it back to that because I'd like to reveal how the mechanics of the policy consensus governance model is in fact a transmission mechanism of actualizing these non-governmental organization wet dreams of the future policy paradise when it comes to environmental bogus science and so forth. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, how policies are maneuvered into the local county level of government, and all government essentially boils down to local government when it comes to how individuals are impacted in their lives, we see this transmission mechanism of a purposefully designed system of moving decision-making and policy establishment outside of normal government structures that are representative in nature, albeit with their flaws, to this largely unaccountable method that uses the grants that come from, more often than not, the Fed, where, you know, and it isn't even an issue of China funding our debt. It's more, at this point, literally running the printing press and creating future obligations for future generations that create the grants that buy off local politicians and local interests to acquiesce and to policy goals that more often than not, or quite frequently, are not in the best interests of average people, but are in fact servicing special interests and ideologically driven policy objectives like Agenda 21. Dennis, you've talked a lot about this whole Ponzi Federal Reserve Magician Act and how it's being marshaled to in fact shape political policy and impact Americans' lives. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
Your listeners may have heard of it called or referred to as the Iron Triangle. And the Iron Triangle is kind of the dynamics of policy making between Congress and special interests and then bureaucracies and government agencies, because those agencies actually are the ones that put the bread and butter on everybody's table. They're the ones that let the subcontracts, they're the ones that go through the PR endeavor, they're the ones who propagate the material, the collateral material, the videos, all of those public service announcements you'll hear on the radio while you're driving to and from work. The reason those public service announcements exist is because there's money borrowed from China to help propagate this message that says everything that government does is good, and that everything that government does is good, they want to ensure that you remember that by the time you make it back into your car to head out to lunch. They're going to tell you again and tell you again. This triangle between Congress and the special interests and the government agencies is extremely powerful. One, because of all the employees in state and federal agencies, and all of the ability that they garner through their administrative law efforts and writing the rules, writing the sanctions, being the judge and jury for all of the people who violate those various rules that they put in place, And as long as their funding is secured from Congress, they're in business. Then for any science that might be necessary to back up their position, it's easy enough to let a science contract to the local university, community college, or even high school to ask students to capture so many fish and to take so many test tubes of water and look at the temperature of that water and make sure they get it from the shade of those trees that were planted, and then take another sample from that sunny spot over there where the water is stagnant and prove to us that water under a tree is cooler than water in the open sun in a stagnant pool, and voila, we can justify hiring a contractor to put more trees along the riverbank. All of this is simply a transfer of wealth from the taxpayer, from people who buy electricity and buy water and live their lives, into the pockets of the wealthy and those crony capitalists that are making money by legislating their way to prosperity. It's really a tragedy because it's done by, quote, consensus, and consensus is the death of America as we know it. The death of representative government.
We talked a lot about environmental actions and environmental examples in our discussion today, and I would like to point out that I consider myself an environmentalist, but, you know, when I was 30 years old, some 15 years ago, I used to be a member of Greenpeace and Sierra Club and card-carrying member of Friends of the Earth and so forth, and over time I've come to understand that a lot of these organizations have been corrupted. They're pursuing agendas and political outcomes that aren't always representing true environmental stewardship. And frankly, my understanding at this point now is so divorced from the way these organizations were, say, in my grandfather's age. I like to joke that the Sierra Club of my grandfather's era is nothing like what it is today. I mean, Ed had mentioned an example of the sue and settle phenomenon, and through the Equal Access to Justice Act, at the federal level, environmental organizations can float lawsuits that by design are intended to, in fact, be settlement vehicles. They get compensated for the legal hours billed to pursue that, and in ultimate reality, you end up getting disincentive system built into the environmental community to aggrandize their infrastructure and growth based on trying to shape politics and ideology as opposed to stuff that's motivated by true science. And I know that a lot of people out there who are just beginning to get that bit of information come across their radar screen will look at that and say, oh, these guys are just nuts. They're, you know, they're not interested in environmental protection. They want to do away with the EPA and all that kind of milieu of understanding. But the fact is, folks, that when the EPA was created under Richard Nixon, a Republican, the goal at the time and the arguments made that shepherded in the organization was one where the EPA would be kind of like a referee or a coach working together with all of the 50 states' environmental protection organizations. And in Oregon, we have DEQ and other, like Department of State Lands, et cetera, that administer all of our environmental rules, and that there would be some coordination, and through the process of government, of representative government, the people through their legislators having impacts on these regulatory agencies would in fact design policies that, A, did the best job possible to administer environmental considerations at the local level, where greater understanding of what actually needs to be done is there, and B, to, you know, make something that works well in coordination as opposed to a top-down federal jackboot stepping down on states and then in turn having this whole consensus policy apparatus working hand-in-hand with the administrative state to impact our lives at a rather huge extent. That, you know, environmental laws now regulate practically everything to the point of suffocation. And, you know, when you look at the coming carbon taxes, I couldn't think of a better example of something like that. I mean, we could conceivably see a 10% reduction in the gross domestic product of the economic activity in the United States across the board in 2016 and beyond when and if carbon taxes come in. So anyway, that was quite a rant, but I think it is important people who are virgin to the understanding that the environmental community has become a big business, and that it's not always about what is the best practices informed by science to guarantee the best environment. And unfortunately, you know, when people in Western states in particular, where in Oregon, as an example, 54% of the state land is in fact held in trust by the federal government, and you know, we have a natural resource economy that's used to be quite substantial here, but now is in fact not, because of excessive regulations that essentially do not manage our resources in an environmental way. And in the West, we've had this huge forest fires and problems of lack of stewardship, where forests are literally rotting and being chewed away by bark beetles and dying because of a vision of environmental policy that isn't, in fact, pursuant to the goals that it claims to champion. I mean, even the spotted owl program is a complete failure. The population is declining, and the principal reason is the poor guys can't get their normal foraged food because the forests have been so overgrown that the owls are not able to find their preferred meals. It's just rather ironic.
I would like to toss something out, and I almost wish I would have addressed it earlier, but actually the points that you bring up, you have to look at this with an understanding. What I outlined earlier, when the state of Oregon abolished this dispute resolution commission, you have to understand a basic principle that it was a state agency. And when they gave it to the college, when they gave it to the university system, it was still a state agency, and then the legislation was passed that transferred it to them and created the college, the university system, as a state agency. So now what you have to understand is through the university network of collaborative governance, these people can collaborate with any agency in the country, any governmental agency in the country. And so all of the things that you just finished outlining are directly related back to these programs in building the administrative state that creates the nightmare that we're in from one action that occurred in 2003. And if you go back historically and you look at how this, how to say, barrage of administrative law has come after us in that time period, well, you can directly attribute it to all of those, you know, those activities, what they did. And every part of this radical environmental law that you see being imposed across the board comes directly from this type of thing in all different states. And every time that you research it, you can go right back and find it in the sources. I'll leave that as my last rant.
It, you know, Eric, you did a good job of summarizing, and I'm glad to hear you mention Greenpeace. You're probably well aware Patrick Moore, one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, is now a staunch advocate against anthropogenic global warming because he recognizes that this is bad science. It's a natural phenomena. It may be being caused by the solar activity, or it may be caused by other things, but it's not necessarily caused by man and pollution. It's caused by things far outside our domain. And if people will remember, North America used to be in the Little Ice Age, and we had 3 feet thick across all most of North America. And when that ice was 3 feet thick, believe me, you couldn't grow corn and you couldn't grow wheat and you wouldn't have forests like we have here in Oregon. And the mantra that says we've got to keep it the way we know it and understand it is really a myopic and small-minded perspective on what the earth is capable of and the prosperity that we could create by having access to these resources instead of letting them go up in forest fires every summer. I live in forested land. My wife and I have lived off the grid for 18 years. And we've lived off the grid for 18 years of our own accord without any federal money, without transferring taxpayer dollars into my pocket, We paid for it ourselves because we believe in stewardship and we're willing to do what we consider the right thing. The other players in this game aren't willing to do the right thing unless they get paid. And that part of the triangle, well, I'll put solar on my garage if the taxpayer pays to put it there, is a great deal, and it's a transfer of wealth from the taxpayer or the electric utility payer into the pockets of those people who are, not only manufacturing the solar arrays and installing the solar arrays, but also the homeowner who says, sure, I'll go along with robbing my neighbor because, quote, it's legal. And quite frankly, it's an immoral place where a crony capitalist market has brought us to, where we think it's legal to steal from our neighbors because the legislature says it's okay.
Yeah, and that gets back to all the alternative power definitions for hydro and so forth that we talked about earlier, where, there are times when the wind generation facilities in Oregon are cranking up so much megawatts that they literally have to turn the hydro power systems off because the grid can't deal with the level of electricity being produced. So essentially you have all this government subsidization distorting the marketplace for the procurement of greater wind generation, only permitted or gotten through the political system because they chose to redefine hydro as not being renewable when in fact it is the lowest cost and constant source of renewable energy like geothermal. Both hydro and geothermal are not intermittent in their source. Sometimes the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day. So, but anyway, gentlemen, I really appreciate the conversation that we've had. It's a subject that's pretty complex at times, yet when you really boil it down to its basic precepts, we're talking about essentially a method of governance as opposed to governant that sidesteps the representative opportunity for people to have their voices heard. And that's really the bottom line. And there needs to be a far greater discussion nationwide about this whole policy consensus apparatus. I follow politics pretty closely, and frankly, this kind of discussion is pretty rare, even up to this late date. That's unfortunate, but hopefully people will tune in and share this radio broadcast with other people. We'll also include some background information, including the video of a presentation that Ed and Dennis did earlier this month in conjunction with Americans for Prosperity and Citizens for Transparent Government, the organization that I run locally. And if anybody's interested in following our work, we are up at Facebook. If you typed in Citizens for Transparent Government at Facebook, you'd find our Facebook page there. Our website is cftg.org. So thanks again, gentlemen.
Thank you, Eric. You're a wonderful host.